Welcome everyone to tonight's training webinar on the Historic Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act's progressive outreach updates and suggestions. The Energy Innovation Act, as we know, is the first bipartisan climate bill introduced into Congress this decade. And on our webinar series of late, we're exploring how to be more effective climate advocates in promoting and having conversations about this legislation. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is going to be covered by the wonderful Stephanie Doyle. Let me introduce her briefly. Stephanie serves as National Outreach and Partnership Coordinator in the DC office of CCL. Much of her work involves building relationships and engaging with other organizations and non-governmental organizations to coordinate efforts on carbon pricing and climate policies at the federal and state level. Her outreach work also involves enhancing CCL chapters' abilities to partner and coordinate locally with other environmental, particularly those that are left of center, businesses and NGO groups. And tonight's webinar is going to be pretty straightforward. We're going to have a chance to talk about national group support, as well as what CCL National is doing about that. We'll have some advice on how to communicate with progressives, as well as how to respond to criticism. Stephanie is then going to go over helping with local outreach. So without further ado, I'll pass it to you, Stephanie, and thank you all for being on the line tonight.
Thanks, Brett. I wanted to start off tonight by going over a few of the national groups that have given statements about the bill. And I've pulled out some of the excerpts from some of the ones that I found that were particularly useful in discussions with progressive groups. So the first ones that I have for you, and I just wanted to say that these are available in here. They're also available if you just Google the organization and carbon fee, you should be able to find them. Eventually, we're going to have a website that lists all of these statements of support. So if you want to find them, or you can just email me and I can send you the whole quote. So the first one we have is National Wildlife Federation. So they said, a carbon fee is an economically sound, market-based idea worthy of Congress's bipartisan consideration and action. We look forward to working with Representatives Deutsch, Rooney, and Fitzpatrick in the next Congress on proactive conservation legislation to address climate change and carbon emissions going forward. And then they also said that the act is the second significant bipartisan carbon fee proposal. The second one that I found really useful was from the Nature Conservancy. And they said, a bill like this, which makes a firm commitment to placing a price on pollution and reducing the emissions that threaten our communities, our health, and our planet, is a necessary component of any effective plan to address climate change. We're pleased to see a bipartisan group of members of the House Climate Solutions Caucus continue to press this issue on Capitol Hill. The next one was from the Environmental Defense Fund, and they said, this new legislation establishes strong pollution reduction goals and harnesses the power of the market, letting businesses choose for themselves how to cut pollution. By acting quickly and boldly to limit carbon and other climate pollutants, we can reduce human vulnerability to increasingly dangerous climate impacts and safeguard the economy against escalating costs. And then they had the extra added part that I pulled out that I found most useful for talking to progressives, which was that it adds to the growing chorus of support for meaningful action to protect our country and the planet. The next three, the first one is actually from a senator. So Senator Whitehouse, who is known as a pretty big climate icon, both on the left and just in Congress generally. And he said, the introduction of this bipartisan legislation is an important step. Virtually every serious economist who has considered the challenge of reducing emissions from the right and the left agrees that setting a price on carbon is the most efficient solution. Indeed, the IPCC in its latest report said a carbon fee is one of the best tools we have to prevent catastrophic climate change. And we also have a quote from Jim Hansen, and his whole quote, the only part of is there, is unbelievable. With 100,000 supporters across the country, CCL now has a climate bill that serves the people by cutting carbon emissions and putting money in people's pockets. Climate change is incredibly urgent and serious, as I warned Congress when I first testified about global warming in 1988. This bill gives us the chance to fight it seriously and on a big scale. I encourage everyone to support the Bipartisan Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And then the last one that I found really useful was from NRDC, and they actually did an entire blog piece about the bill, which is really great. It goes into extensive detail. They even did some modeling showing how incredible it is. So I pulled out the parts that they talked about, the good things. They do mention some of their issues with it as well, which are mostly around the regulation. But I just wanted to read some of that. So they said, "We're pleased to see members of both parties working together on a bill designed to curb dangerous climate change, and we are particularly thankful for renewed Republican leadership on this topic. Climate protection wasn't always the partisan issue it has become, and it should not remain so going forward. The bill's targets are linked to strong environmental goals. Its reduction goals, stronger than those proposed by Representative Curbelo and others, appear consistent with the contribution required of the United States to holding global warming under 2 degrees Celsius. In light of the extreme danger in exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius revealed by the IPCC, it is important to include a mechanism for strengthening the bill's targets. The bill uses market mechanisms to cost-effectively achieve its emissions goals, and it provides for regularly reviewing and adjusting carbon emission fees as needed to meet those goals. The bill commits the U.S. to re-engaging constructively in international efforts to reduce climate change. The Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act reflects a serious effort to respond to the gravity of the climate disruption we are already experiencing and will only worsen if we fail to act. Most importantly, it is sponsored by both Republicans and Democrats." So those are just some of the statements that have been put out. There's also been more from some groups that would be considered sort of eco-right groups, as well as a few statements from business coalitions such as C2ES and Ceres. And you can look those ones up on your own if you think those would be helpful for your discussions with allies, or you can email me and I can send those along. And eventually, like I said, we'll have a website with all of these statements of support, as well as any endorsements that we get. And then I also just wanted to mention that our Environmental Justice Action Team has reached out to the Hip Hop Caucus, who were initially, they met with them in June, and they were supportive of the proposal, supportive of dividends, although we aren't sure exactly where they are on this bill as of yet, but we're continuing to do outreach on it. And yeah, I'll mention that again as we move along. So what is CCL National and what am I doing as far as outreach to other organizations? So this slide, I wanted to just talk about a bit of what I do and what CCL National does all the time to engage with other environmental groups, but and additionally around the bill. So we are part of numerous roundtable strategy sessions and tables of subtables of subgroups that include all of the following organizations to some capacity. So this is Sierra Club, LCV, EDF, NRDC, Green for All, Public Citizen, Friends Committee on National Legislation, Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Fund, Sunrise Movement, Union of Concerned Scientists, National Wildlife Federation, WRI, Blue Green Alliance, Earth Justice, and many, many more. So that means that I know people at all those organizations. I'm in regular communication with them. I have the ability to converse with them about the bill or just topics in general. And we sit at tables where we're talking about how to coordinate the greater climate movement. I also continue to meet with representatives from groups who are not supportive of the bill, or are not supportive of market-based mechanisms to continue the dialogue and build up the trust there. And additionally, multiple members of Citizens Climate Lobby, including Brett and I, sit on subcommittees of the U.S. Climate Action Network, which is a group of groups that works to, they basically are a big, not a coalition, but a group that works to coordinate all of the left of center climate groups in the United States. And so we sit on different strategy groups within that include Just Transitions, Building Grassroots Power. And then there's another group within that is working on a 2020 platform for Democrats around climate change in an effort to come up with something that the biggest group number of groups can sign on to. And those conversations do skew to the left, but our participation as a bipartisan organization helps to keep us in that conversation. And I think it really adds and helps continue people to think through the different tactics that there are to tackling climate change. And it allows for an openness and cooperation for climate solutions with varying degrees of support from those groups involved. And then I also wanted to touch on one thing, which is a reminder that groups are going to disagree with us, and that's okay. And that often when there's no statement or a group is being quiet, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It can mean that they're just not supportive and they're choosing to, you know, the phrase, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all, which is fine. I think that in some cases we would welcome, we'd rather them be quiet than say something negative. But in other cases, groups are quiet because they see their role in the climate movement as being the left flank. And so I wanted to give an example. I've had many groups come up to me and tell me that they support our work, that they're glad that we're the ones doing it because they can't be the ones doing it because of their position in the climate movement. And so an example was after Curbelo lost, I had a major green group come up to me and tell me that they were really worried about the narrative that Curbelo lost because of climate, and that they wished groups were working on changing that narrative. And I said, CCL is trying to change that narrative. And they really appreciated that we were doing that because they knew that they couldn't, because it wouldn't be authentic for them as a messenger to be out there making that message. So I just wanted to touch on that. Just because a group is quiet or hasn't made a statement yet is not necessarily a bad thing. And one other thing to mention on that as well, this bill was submitted at the end of this Congress. So a lot of groups may not want to stick their necks out and take a position on something that they see as going away. I think there will be more robust conversation when we get this reintroduced in the next Congress. That's my sense of it. So I wanted to talk about how you can best talk about this bill with progressive allies, and how I've done a bit of talking about it. So before we go into that, though, some opening considerations, and if any of you have seen me talk about doing outreach, you'll have seen these already, but I think they're really important to remember that whenever we do outreach to other organizations, this is not a one and done type of thing. It's not a transactional, we want an endorsement and then we're never going to talk to them again. It's the same way that we should think of our relationships with our members of Congress. This should be a relationship. You want to open a conversation rather than winning a debate with somebody. And you want to keep it open so that we can accept criticisms, we can take people's suggestions, and not have them feel like we are set in stone and that this is the be-all end-all. And so one really good way to do that is to focus on your shared vision for a carbon-free future. So that may mean when you meet with a group saying, I understand that you want 100% renewable energy by 2050, so do I. And then talk back from that about how you get to that. The next thing to really is that it's really important to remember is to not assume that carbon-free and dividends is the best or the only solution. It's not. I think especially nowadays, you know, there's going to need to be many, many complementary policies that go along with this. We know that a carbon price is not as powerful on transportation, say, or some of those more carbon intensive industries. So there's always going to be a need for more policies. And we should never sell this as the only solution or the best. We just think it's one piece of a much larger climate solutions puzzle, silver buckshot. I've heard that as a way to describe it. And with that, being able to say that and have humility and authenticity is really going to go a long way in your conversations to be able to say, you know, we understand that this isn't the only solution. We just see this as the best one, the one that has the best chance of passing in the nearest future. And I'll touch on a little bit of theory of change and how that plays into it as well in a bit. And then I just wanted to put in a plug for CCL's Climate and Environmental Justice Action Team. They do incredible work on thinking through how we do outreach to those groups. And that it really, the one thing I wanted to stress is that it's not, again, you don't want this to be transactional in any way. We need to be forming relationships and having dialogues with groups. And I'll talk about at the end some suggestions for how you can do that in district. But if you are interested in specifically outreach to those groups, I suggest joining that action team and being a part of that discussion. So when you are talking about the bill, these are some points that are good to hit on that address a lot of the shared values that progressives have. And I'm going to go through these, and then we're going to go through some criticism rebuttal type examples as well. So the first one is talking about that this bill creates jobs and protects people through the dividend. So we know that this creates 2.1 million new jobs based off of our modeling, thanks to the growth in the clean energy economy. But it's important to point out that those jobs aren't all in clean energy jobs. They're jobs that are from the boost of the dividend as well. When people get money in their pockets, they spend it, they go to the doctor more. So a lot of the job growth is in healthcare. A lot of that information can be found in REMI, but I just wanted to reiterate that the jobs that are created are not all in the clean energy economy, but many of them will be. And then that the dividend protects low income and those who are the most harmed by climate from protecting them from rising energy costs. Most people in the lowest income come out ahead with this policy. It's important to remember or to remind people that the dividend isn't going to bump anyone off of means tested programs. So that means that if you're on welfare and you get an increase in your income from the dividend, it won't count towards that, you getting the welfare. Additionally, it's important to point out that this allows states to continue to pursue their own climate policies. So if a state wants to go further, they can do that. This doesn't impact that. The second point is to talk about that it reduces health impacts from pollution and saves lives. So this is the sort of number that we have is that poor air quality is responsible for an estimated 60,000 deaths in the United States, and thousands more are sickened. It's important to point out that this bill is going to impact direct impacts from pollution, since coal is the immediate the industry that is immediately impacted from a price and will be gone the quickest, so within 10 years. And that means that a lot of those extra health impacts from coal and oil refineries that are right behind that will be cleaned up through the price. Number three is that it's extremely effective at cutting emissions. So this bill is expected to reduce emissions by at least 40% in America over the next 12 years and 90% by 2050. This is the most comprehensive because it addresses all fossil fuel combustion in the US plus fluorinated gases. Previous bills that have been introduced, they set targets of 80% emissions reductions, or they set targets of 100% reductions, but only for certain sectors. So only in the electricity sector or only in the transportation sector. This is one of the first bills that actually address economy-wide emissions. And those targets that we set are far better than what we pledged for Paris, which was 26 to 28% reductions by 2025. Or what was expected from the Clean Power Plan, which was supposed to be a 32% reduction in just the electricity sector by 2030. And they're even stronger than the targets set by California and its cap and trade program, which was 80% reduction by 2050. And the targets in this bill were written to meet the goals of staying below 2 degrees Celsius by the IPCC. And it's also in line with most of the modeling for staying below 1.5 degrees as well. And then it's important to talk about that this policy does limit EPA regulations on greenhouse gases, but it's only as long as the emissions targets are being met. If after 10 years targets are not met, the policy calls for the EPA to implement additional regulations to meet those targets. This gives clear direction to the EPA from Congress that would actually prevent a lot of the court cases that have been coming up around the Clean Power Plan. It directly says EPA not only has to regulate for greenhouse gases, it has to meet these targets and make up for whatever was missed. So that is what happens if the tax doesn't work, which most economists don't expect that to happen. And then additionally, the policy provides for continued authority of the EPA over air and water. It allows for the continuation of CAFE standards. It allows for any type of regulation. You can regulate coal for particulates. You can regulate it for health. You can regulate methane. You can regulate fracking. You can put a ban on fracking if you want. It doesn't stop any new policies from being implemented. And it explicitly, again, preserves the rights of states to regulate greenhouse gases if they want to go further. And then fourth, it has the support of trusted messengers. And so before I touch on this one, the messenger pick slide that we have next, who shows up on this, they support carbon pricing generally. This is not support for carbon fee and dividend necessarily, although we're working on that. So these are some of the messengers that we've used in the past to talk to progressive allies, people that will resonate much more with the left than some of CCL's most famous spokespeople like Catherine Hayhoe and Bob Inglis. And these include Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders, the Pope, Bill McKibben, Stephen Chu, and Robert Reich, who've all talked about carbon pricing as being part of a climate solution and being a needed one in the past. And then Brett has some of these quotes from some of these people. I'm not going to read them. They've been in previous presentations, but if you want to find them, you can find them in these slides. And again, these are for carbon pricing generally, but they are beneficial when you're talking about carbon pricing from a more general perspective. And these are some additional carbon fee champions. So these are all Democrats who have submitted some type of carbon pricing bill in the past three Congresses. Some of these are caps, some of these have dividends, but they're important to point out to Democratic congresspeople and progressive allies that this has been a longstanding solution from the left. This is not a new policy. It's always been a part of what a climate solution should be. So yeah, now we're going to do a little bit of a deeper dive on responding to some criticisms. And first, I wanted to mention a little bit about that when you talk about this policy, the best way to talk about it is as a yes and policy. And so you don't want to say yes, but means you're dismissing someone's concerns, and we really don't want to do that. You always want to be upfront and acknowledge any issues and shortcomings. And acknowledge, again, that this is a first step and that we understand the urgency of the problem. And that's why we think this is the best first step. So this is where I wanted to talk about CCL's theory of change, which I think, to me, I've found that in explaining our theory of change to other groups, it explains why we work the way that we do. So CCL believes that the climate crisis is so urgent that we don't have time to wait till 2021. For climate action, or we don't have time to wait for Democrats to control every part of government. We think that you can get enough done now to address the problem, that it makes sense to be working on as much as we can to get emissions reductions in now. Other groups don't believe that. They believe that you need to wait until you have Democrats in control, that whatever comes from a compromise is not going to be good enough. And I point that out because it's important to acknowledge that we have different theories of change, and that that's okay, that it's needed to have groups working on climate from different theories, from different tactics and different strategies. And as long as we're all aiming in the same direction and coordinating, which is what my job is to work on, is making sure that we are coordinating with other groups. It's okay to have us all working from this different perspectives. And additionally, that it's okay that we can aim for more emissions reductions. We can aim for additional policies. We can aim for better adaptation, for just transition, while also working to put a price on carbon. That those are not against each other. They are complementary. And that we do need to do all of that. And then I just wanted to add a plug for Tony's blog that he put out today, which talks a lot about those targets that I was talking about and how effective the bill is. I think it's going to be a really good tool for for working with progressive audiences to use this blog. All right, and so now I'm going to go into just some examples of concerns that I've heard, and then some shared values and statements that you can use to, when you respond. These were worked through by the CCL staff, and there's lots of other ones. These were just the ones that I thought might be the most useful for you. But if you have other questions or you've heard other concerns, please feel free to raise them or email me after this if we don't get to them. So the first one is, this policy will hurt low-income communities who already suffer the worst impacts of climate change. Polluters will continue to pollute in those neighborhoods unless they are stopped. And you can respond to this by saying that low-income communities do suffer the worst of climate change and environmental pollution. Our policy will greatly reduce the pollution in low-income communities that is related to fossil fuel production and combustion, especially from coal, which is a significant source of health impacts. So you really want to address the concern. We're not trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes. We completely understand that low-income communities do suffer the worst of climate pollution, and that this can help just address the very beginning of that. The next one is, this policy will hurt people who are employed in coal and oil industries. There is no plan for a just transition to new jobs. So a possible response that you could say is, we support job retraining for all people employed in endangered industries. It's not included in this bill, but we would be supportive of money allocated by Congress for this priority. And what's really great about this is that you now have opened up a conversation with somebody, especially if this is a labor organization or someone who's working on just transition, to talk about what the language is that they would want to see in a bill. What is the exact language that they would need to see to get on board? Or what bills are they working on that CCL could lend help to moving? So keeping the conversation open and really thinking through, again, that yes and, how we get to that is what you want to aim for. So the next one is, clearly this policy is bad because it is supported by Republicans. So one possible way you can respond is, a lasting solution to climate change deserves and needs bipartisan support in order to be passed before 2020 and to survive intact when majority party leadership changes. So this goes to, again, that theory of change that we don't have time to wait until 2020. And even if we do have to wait until then, there's always going to be a possibility of another Donald Trump. There's always going to be the possibility of a Republican administration coming in and doing exactly what they've done for the past 2 years. And that having something that is bipartisan enables for a robust, long-lasting solution. The next one is, clearly this policy is bad because oil companies are supportive, who are happy to pass a tax, which they will pass on to consumers and continue doing business as usual. So again, one possible response is, oil companies know that climate change needs to be addressed. Oil companies prefer a predictable, transparent, market-driven solution that allows them to plan their business to an approach that chooses alternative energy winners. Oil companies cannot avoid the carbon tax, but they can innovate low carbon sources of energy. So this one, again, you know, there's some groups that are never, ever, ever going to be supportive of anything that an oil company supports. And like I said before, that is okay. We need groups like that in the ecosystem to be pushing on oil companies to be better, on governments to make sure they're held accountable. But you can also point out that the reasoning of why they support this, the logic behind it, that it's not that they're trying to make more money. So the next one is, this policy won't work because this approach doesn't guarantee emissions reductions. We should use regulations instead. So this one, a good response is, regulations are most effective when focused on a specific industry, not focused across a large number of industries. Because carbon is so pervasive throughout our economy, a broad tool like our policy is simpler, easier to implement, less expensive, and more effective. We do still see a place for regulations, but regulations cannot replace the broad impact of this policy. And additionally, this policy allows for an increase in the fee in the event that emissions targets are not being met. So there is a bump up by $5 if the targets aren't met, and you can also add in that emissions come back stronger if they're not met at that 10-year mark. The next one is, this policy won't work because it will push us toward fracking, which is harmful due to methane emissions. And a response could be, the electricity sector is already shifting from coal to natural gas for reasons of price. Carbon pricing will accelerate the transition from natural gas to renewables faster than most other approaches. This policy allows for regulations on fracking for both methane leakage and environmental concerns other than global warming. So this is where you can talk about the fact that methane can still be regulated. There can be new policies on fracking. Like I said, there could be a fracking ban and it would not really interfere with this policy. That's a response for that one. And then this one, which I'm sure was going to come up on this call that I wanted to address, is how does this policy relate to the Green New Deal? So the Green New Deal is an exciting and impressive movement, one that is drawing new and needed attention to the climate problem. I work and have known Evan Weber, who is the founder of Sunrise. He's been in the climate spaces that I've been in for the past 3 years. And we're again, like I said, we sit at very similar strategy tables, at the same strategy tables. He's at all of those strategy meetings that I am at, and we are working to coordinate our efforts. And then just to bring up, can a Green New Deal include a carbon tax? Yes, of course it can. It's a great pay for, but we really don't want to be forceful in bringing this to Sunrise or forcing that on them or trying to co-opt the language of the Green New Deal by saying, this new Energy Innovation Act is a Green New Deal. That's not cool. We wouldn't want another group to do that to us. We wouldn't want them to force whatever their new policy is on us. So we shouldn't do that back. The way I like to think of this is like good cop, bad cop. So you have Sunrise. The day we had our lobby day, Sunrise was doing a forceful public action while we were on the inside having those nitty-gritty policy conversations with members. And you really need both of those factions for members of Congress to feel pressure, but to also be able to move in the direction that we want. These are not competitive ideas. We don't want to make them into competitive ideas. They should not be talked about as competitive ideas. They're complementary and they can go together. But again, we really don't want to co-opt their messaging. We want the Green New Deal to let their policy efforts play out. I think one place where you can have this conversation that's really useful is with your member of Congress. If your member of Congress is asking about it in a meeting, you can bring up that a carbon price could be a part of a Green New Deal, and that that's an important part of any climate solution, according to the IPCC. We just really want to be conscious and careful when we're interacting in public because, like I said, it's an organization. You don't want to be forcing our input on them and the same way we wouldn't want it on us. And I think we'll know more as the Green New Deal plays out. Right now, there's not a lot of details about what's in it and what it would look like. And so I don't think we need to get really worried about a carbon price being a part of it until we get to see more of that play out in Congress over the next couple months. So some closing considerations when you're having conversations about the bill is you always, always, always want to center in our shared values. So respect, appreciation, and gratitude. We really want to respect and appreciate and be grateful for all these organizations that do such incredible work that is different from us and respect that there are going to be different tactics. There are going to be different theories of change. And we have to accept that we're probably going to need all of them if we're going to handle the climate crisis in the time that we need it to be solved in. You really want to listen for those underlying concerns and identify them in the conversation. It is great if we can find out what a group is concerned about, what specific line in that bill they don't like or would want changed. If you find those out, send them to me. I would be thrilled to find, to get some of this feedback about what tweaks people would want to see to enhance the bill. And it's a living document. It's important to talk to people that way, that the bill is not finished. It's going to get reintroduced. It's going to change. And that we are ready and willing to accept input from organizations that want to have a dialogue about what that looks like. And then lastly, above all, be polite. That's really simple one. Be polite and always try to leave the door open for further conversation. We don't ever want our interactions with other groups to be, like I said, a one and done transactional interaction. This is going to be a long process, and we really need to be able to build relationships there so we can go back and continue the dialogue and not just cut that off from ever happening. So this is how you can help me and help us with our outreach. So it's really important to remember that I am talking with all of these national organizations. There's no need to contact Sierra Club's policy person or NRDC's top VP of climate. I work with them, I know them, and it's actually confusing if they get bombarded by lots of CCLers. If you do have a connection to a green group or one of these organizations that you think is unique and useful and could move the conversation, please let me know. I'm happy to work with you to coordinate on how we can leverage that. And I think that's really valuable. I know many of you are involved in these groups. So please do let me know if you have those and you want to work together to use them. But at the local level, you're far more likely to move these organizations than at the national level. So like I said, I work with Sierra Club National, but that does not mean that you can't go reach out to Sierra Club Local, 350, all of these organizations that have chapters, and then of course the groups that are specific to your state or to your city. You can talk about the bill, but one thing to remember is that getting an endorsement is not necessarily going to be, it's great to if you can, but the bill is most likely going to change a bit before it gets reintroduced. So you really want to have a relationship so you can go back to that group and say, you endorsed this the first time, but there were some slight tweaks. We just want to double check that you're still okay with it, or be able to go back and continue that conversation. Additionally, finding out, like I said, what changes a group would want to see for them to get on board, please, that is valuable information. And if you can pass that on up to me, that's great. It helps our discussions. If they have a policy person that wants to discuss some of that nitty gritty policy wonk stuff, and they want to talk to a DC person, feel free to pass them along. And then one thing I wanted to touch on additionally is opening up the conversation wider than carbon fees in this policy. So when you're in district and you are working on establishing a relationship with a group, find out what they're working on. Maybe you can work on it too. There's CCLers are amazing. We have such bandwidth and we're involved in so many incredible things. I think we need to give ourselves a little bit more leeway to work on other topics as they fit into our larger vision. So if you have a group and you have the bandwidth to work on a state initiative, that's great. You should do that. And you should do that respectfully and with the groups that are working on that. Jamie is our state coordinator and he can help you if you want to plug into an existing effort. But it doesn't even have to be that big. It can be something as simple as maybe you're going to put on a climate education town hall with another group and you're just going to talk about climate generally. That's totally fine. We don't always have to be talking about the bill. We want to, like I said, establish those relationships, and the same way in any relationship, you don't want it to be one-sided. We need to be better at saying, how can CCL help you? We have resources. We can help teach people how to lobby. There's so many things that we're really good at that I think will go a long way in helping us improve our relationships with some of these groups.
Make sure to please reach out to both Stephanie or I. Our emails are here as well as the forum link in community and the main information page in community out in the public-facing Energy Innovation Act URL as well. So hope that you found this useful. I'll put all these links in the chat window as well so you can get them in your download if you're interested. And I'll unmute all lines and wish all of you an empowered and motivated week ahead. We're making huge progress and we can't do it without you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.